Good morning. Welcome to the Court of Appeals. It's my understanding that the parties are here for our 9 o'clock argument and that they are ready. Before we begin, I wanted to introduce the panel to you. To my right is Justice Dabney Basil. To my left is Justice Dana Womack, and I'm Chief Justice Bonnie Sutterth. Before we begin the argument, I'll ask the clerk to call the case.
May it please the court. The court will now call Liberty Bankers Life Insurance Company versus AIL Investments LP. Mr. William Dravel will argue for appellant. Ms. Caitlin Hubbard will argue for appellant.
Thank you. You may begin.
May it please the court. My name is Bill Drabble, and I represent the appellants, Liberty Bankers Life Insurance Company and TX Cooley Sub 3 LLC. Affirming summary judgment would require this court to overlook material and, in many cases, uncontroverted evidence that raises a fact issue on Liberty and TX Cooley's relationship and the terms of Liberty's conveyance of the property. First, that evidence shows that the conveyance was not an arm's-length transaction that actually changed control over the property, which means that Liberty did not make or receive a bona fide offer that triggered AIL's right of first refusal. Second, that evidence raises a fact question on whether TX Cooley was controlled by Liberty and hence was its affiliate, which exempts the conveyance from AIL's right of first refusal. And third, the evidence shows that not only did TX Cooley agree to pay $1.96 million for the property, but it also agreed to deliver the stock certificate and the stock power. Since AIL introduced no evidence that it is ready, willing, and able to deliver equivalent documents to Liberty, AIL did not establish its entitlement to specific performance as a matter of law. This morning, I plan to limit my discussion to those 3 points, but Liberty and TX Cooley are not waiving their challenges to the award of attorney's fees, for which they rest on their brief. Turning to my first point, Liberty neither made nor received a bona fide offer that triggered AIL's right of first refusal. The types of offers that will trigger a right of first refusal have 3 components. First, they must be made in good faith. Second, they must be firm. And third, they must be made in an arm's-length transaction that would actually change control over the property. In Jones versus Riley, this court held that the first 2 components are required. Whether the 3rd component is also required is an open question in Texas. But the great weight of authority supports answering that question, yes. Beginning in 1956 in Sand versus London and Company, courts across the country have said that an arm's-length transaction and an actual change in control over the property is necessary to trigger a right of first refusal. AIL has identified only 1 case that went the other way in that nearly 70-year period. It was an unpublished decision out of an intermediate court in Minnesota. So while requiring an arm's-length transaction and a change in control is not the unanimous rule, it is the clear and overwhelming majority rule, and we ask this court to adopt it. And here the summary judgment evidence shows that there was neither an arm's-length transaction nor a change in control. Let's start with the arm's-length transaction. That requires the parties to have relatively equal bargaining power and each to be acting in its own interest. And the evidence here shows that TX Cooley had no bargaining power at all. Liberty's president, Bradford Phillips, dictated the terms of the conveyance. Liberty's attorney drew up the loan documents and represented both Liberty and TX Cooley in the transaction. And then TX Cooley's manager, Robert Murray, signed the loan documents without even reading them. There was no point in Murray reading the loan documents because he couldn't back out of the transaction or change any of its terms. Additionally, those terms were negotiated without regard to the property's value. The evidence shows that the purchase price for the property, $1.96 million, was the amount of Intermodal's loan that was listed on Liberty's books at the time.
But the way the transaction was documented, it looks like an arm's length transaction, didn't it?
Well, the arm's length transaction looks beyond the documents that were actually entered into and into the negotiations between the parties, and there were no negotiations in this case. As I said, there was no dealing at all between Liberty and TX Cooley. Liberty just said, here's what the terms are, and TX Cooley had to accept them. It is documented as a seller finance sale, but that seller finance sale was not negotiated, and TX Cooley lacked the ability to negotiate. So this was not an arm's length transaction in that regard. As I was saying, one of the key things is the difference between the purchase price and the value of the property. $1.96 million was the purchase price, but a near contemporaneous appraisal showed that the value of the property was $3.15 million at the time. So Liberty is transferring the property for only 62% of its value. Now, AIL argues that value is irrelevant, that they are entitled to purchase the property on whatever price Liberty agreed to sell it. But that assumes that the right of first refusal has been triggered in the first instance. And the disparity between price and value shows that this was not an arm's length transaction, especially because the record is devoid of any evidence that there were exigent circumstances that forced Liberty to sell at below market value, or that it simply cut a bad deal. As I've said, all the evidence shows that there was no dealing at all. And the reason there was no dealing is because at all times, Liberty had both formal and informal control over TX Cooley. And I'll start with the formal control. It's undisputed that the transfer of a certificated security transfers all of the rights in that security. As the Texas Supreme Court held in Strange versus Houston and Texas Central Railway, as between the shareholder as in his assignee, the equitable, if not legal, title to the stock would pass by a transfer of the certificate, and this without it being recorded on the books of the company. That was true when Strange was decided in 1880, and that remains true under Article 8 of the Uniform Commercial Code, which governs today. It's important to note that AIL does not dispute the legal consequences of delivering a certificated security. It's also undisputed that Murray actually delivered the stock certificate and the stock power. Possession of the stock certificate gave Liberty all of the rights that Murray had as the sole shareholder of TX Cooley's parent company.
I've got a question about that, but doesn't Winterson have the control of the stock certificate?
Liberty did give the stock certificate to Winterson because it was handling the accounting for the Texas Cooley group of entities. But Article 8 expressly allows other persons to hold a certificate on behalf of someone else. And to transfer the certificate to Winterson, it would have to be a purchaser, which it is not because there was no consideration exchange and there was certainly no gift. Liberty was just giving it to Winterson as a matter of administrative convenience. So Liberty had possession of the stock certificate, which gave it all of the rights to TX Cooley's membership interest and the right to replace Murray as the sole manager of TX Cooley. But that's just the evidence of formal control. There's also ample evidence of informal control. Liberty caused TX Cooley to be created in the first place for the sole and express purpose of holding the title to this property. Liberty then installed Murray as the manager, and Murray testified that he was acting as Liberty's agent and nominee. Likewise, Phillips testified that he told Murray how to run the company, Murray followed his directions, and that Murray would have been removed if he didn't. So there is no change in control when the property transfers from Liberty to TX Cooley, because Liberty always controlled TX Cooley. And thus, there wasn't a bona fide offer that would trigger AIL's right of first refusal. But even if there were, there is a fact issue on whether Liberty and TX Cooley are affiliates. Exhibit E to the deed between Intermodal and AIL created the right of first refusal, and it has an express exemption for transfers between affiliates. Affiliates is defined in a manner that's consistent with its ordinary meaning. Two companies are affiliates if one owns the other, or they're both under common control. Excuse me, if one controls the other and one, both are under common control. Control is defined in Exhibit E as the possession, directly or indirectly, of the power to direct or cause the direction of the management and policies of a company. And here I've just gone through, there's ample evidence that Liberty had control over TX Cooley. Liberty and TX Cooley offer that evidence below. On the other side, AIL offer contrary evidence. They pointed to the loan documents, which do contain statements to the effect that Liberty and TX Cooley are not affiliates. Questions on both sides, that's a fact issue for the jury to determine at a trial, not the trial court to determine at summary judgment. Unless, of course, the loan documents are dispositive. And that's one of the questions for the court today is, are they dispositive? Fortunately, the Supreme Court has already answered that question. No. In Coastal Plains Development Court versus Micrea, the Supreme Court held that when the record demonstrates that the actual effect of the arrangement resulting from the agreement is to create a status different than that stated in the language of the contract, the party's designations will not control. The Supreme Court has never overruled Coastal Plains, and its factual and procedural history, I think, are illustrative here. That was a dispute between two parties to the contract. Coastal Plains and Micrea had agreed that they were not partners or joint venturers. Coastal Plains later takes an inconsistent position in the litigation. If AIL was right, the Supreme Court should have made short work of that argument and said, Coastal Plains, you agreed in your contract that you are not a joint venture and you're prohibited from contesting that. Your contract is dispositive. But that's not what the Supreme Court did in Coastal Plains. Instead, it examined the substance of the relationship to determine whether it matched the contractual description. And ultimately concluded that it did, because the parties didn't have an agreement for the sharing of losses, which at the time was required for a joint venture. The difference between Coastal Plains in this case is that Liberty and TX Cooley have introduced evidence that the substance of their relationship does differ from the description in the contract. And that raises a fact issue which would preclude summary judgment. AIL raises the parole evidence rule in response to all of this, saying that it prohibits Liberty and TX Cooley from contradicting the terms of the documents they used. But the parole evidence rule does not apply to strangers to a contract under these circumstances. AIL is not a party to any of the loan documents. It's not a third party beneficiary of any of the loan documents. And it's not bound by any of the loan documents.
Your deed of trust was made subject to the right of first refusal, wasn't it?
I'm sorry?
You're the deed of trust. Liberty's deed of trust took subject to the right of first refusal.
That's correct, yes.
And after its foreclosure, it was still subject to the right of first refusal.
That's correct, yes.
Okay. So it's a stranger to the transaction.
Yes. AIL is a stranger to the transaction because it's not bound by any of the loan documents. It has an option to accept them if the transfer if it wants to, but it's not bound to accept them. So therefore, it can introduce evidence that would vary or contradict the loan document's terms. The door swings both ways. Both Liberty and TX Cooley can introduce contrary evidence. They've done that here, and that raises a fact issue on that point. Finally, even if summary judgment was appropriate on the issue of liability, it was inappropriate on the issue of remedy, particularly specific performance. To obtain specific performance, AIL had the burden of conclusively establishing that it was ready, willing, and able to offer to perform on the same terms that Liberty dictated to TX Cooley. And in exchange for the property, TX Cooley gave up three things. Gave up the promissory note in the amount of $1.96 million, gave up a vendor's lien on the property, and it gave up the share certificate, the stock certificate, and the stock power. AIL introduced no evidence that it was ready, willing, and able to perform that third condition and deliver equivalent documents to Liberty. Instead, AIL just says that that wasn't part of the deal, but Liberty and TX Cooley introduced evidence that it was, and again, that creates a fact issue at the very least on the terms of the transaction. Obviously, there's evidence that the delivery occurred, and Phillips testified that it was essential to the deal. He would not have transferred the property to TX Cooley, and certainly not for 62% of its value, unless he actually controlled TX Cooley. AIL has two responses to this. It invokes the statute of frauds again, and the parole evidence rule again, and the statute of frauds. I've already discussed the parole evidence rule, but the statute of frauds would not preclude this evidence from coming in either. Statute of frauds, like the parole evidence rule, does not apply to non-parties to the contract. And even if it did, the statute of frauds does not require that the writing contain all of the consideration exchanged. Parties are allowed to present additional evidence of payment terms. And in fact, in Botella versus Meisner Collins Company, the Supreme Court rejected the argument that it was required to test contractual completeness as to the terms of payment by the contract and by that alone. So this court can look outside the contract to see the consideration that was exchanged and for the property, and that consideration included the delivery of the stock certificate and the stock power. So for those reasons, there's a fact issue on the terms of the deal. AIL cannot simply rewrite the deal and accept the terms as rewritten. That's a rejection. That's not specific performance. For those reasons, this court should reverse the trial court summary judgment and render a judgment in favor of Liberty and TX Cooley, or remand for further proceedings. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Hubbard?
Good morning. May it please the court, Caitlin Hubbard for Appley AIL Investment. Your Honors, the only parties attempting to rewrite the deal are appellants. It is undisputed in this case that the unambiguous and fully integrated sale documents, the very sale documents that effectuated the sale that breached the right of first refusal, stated that appellants at that time were in no event affiliates and had no control over the other. And they also were heavily secured and well-papered documents for a $2 million sale that unquestionably is a bona fide transaction under any person's review. Stated otherwise, the very sale documents at issue conclusively established the breach. And what is happening here is that appellants want the court to recognize a brand new rule in which, instead of looking to the underlying offer, if it's given, or the underlying contract, if it's not, that court should look through those unambiguous documents and allow the breaching parties to change the terms. We think the trial court correctly rejected that effort, and we'd ask this court to do the same. I'd like to begin on this affiliate issue because it is the first exception and really the primary and only exception that we believe that appellants tried to raise below. They, of course, repackaged that into a bona fide defense later, but I think affiliate and affiliation is the primary issue before this court. As you've heard, the right of first refusal defines the affiliate term, and it is unambiguous. It means any person with the right to control another. If a sale is between affiliates, it does not trigger the right of first refusal. Here, the trial court correctly held that appellants were not affiliates, for this sale because their own conveyance documents, the only documents that matter for purposes of determining if there were a breach, said that they had no special relationship, that they were not parties or joint venturers, that lender, Liberty, was not in control of Texas Cooley Sub, and they even said, using what appellants described as a shockingly similar definition, that Liberty and Texas Cooley Sub were, quote, in no event affiliates. That was dispositive, as the trial court ruled. What appellants are arguing today and in their briefing are two exceptions that they are trying to use to get around it and create that look-through that I mentioned earlier in the argument. I'd like to begin with the one that was raised in the reply brief, which is the stranger to the contract argument. Justice Basil, as you rightly noted, we are no contractual stranger. We are subject. That right of first refusal is built into the deed. And beyond that, not only is it built into the deed, but under binding Texas Supreme Court authority, our obligation, as appellants note elsewhere in the brief, is to accept the third-party offer and purchase on the very same terms of that agreement. And Texas Cooley Sub, as the purchaser with notice, steps into the shoes of Liberty and has to sell it to us. We are inextricably interrelated, and that is how both this right of first refusal and Texas law works. Now, we filed a letter brief yesterday, unopposed motion for leave to address this new reply brief stranger argument. I do not expect the court to have digested that overnight, so if you'd allow me, I'd like to hit the high points. The upshot of it is that what appellants argue in their reply brief, and mostly a string cite of quoted cases, is a oversimplified and far overstated version of that rule. Both the first and the third courts of appeals have in fact noted that parties commonly misapprehend this rule, and here's what they said. The question has been raised whether the parole evidence rule is applicable in favor of or against a third party who has not been a party to the written integration. The answer, I quote, is definitively in the affirmative if the rule is correctly stated and understood. What is happening in the briefing is that appellants are not correctly stating and understanding that rule. I'll show you how. It creates a dichotomy. If you are somehow bound by or claiming rights under an agreement, then the parole evidence applies. You may invoke it, and you may not get around it, whether you are non-party or not. Likewise, if the evidence is offered, parole evidence is offered for the very purpose of contradicting a fully integrated agreement, then the parole evidence rule will again apply. And as the third and first courts noted, without regard to the identity of the person who may be asserting or denying the fact. On the other hand, if you're claiming no rights under the agreement, or if you're making an argument, party or non-party, that would not be subject to the parole evidence rule in the first place. For instance, that a document is not fully integrated, that there has been a fraud, that there's ambiguity. Certainly, the parole evidence rule is not going to apply. And when you go and you look to these decisions and you coalesce them and you look at the major commentators on contract law, that's what all of them say. The dichotomy is quite logical. Obviously, non-parties may not invoke a rule that parties could not, or vice versa. This case, however, is of the former sort. We are not strangers to the contract, as you noted, Justice Basil, and appellants, under sworn testimony, said that they did not dispute the terms of their freely integrated agreements, that they did not believe them unintentional, incorrect, or misleading. Now, if there were any dispute, there are two Texas Supreme Court decisions that confirm this very outcome. The first was 1964 Cannon versus Pearson. In that case, plaintiffs who had executed a release argued that, notwithstanding their unambiguous text, that in fact they subjectively did not intend to release a physician who was a non-party to the release. The Texas Supreme Court had this to say: the parole evidence rule bars the effort, and it matters not that the defendants, the physician, who invoke the rule are not parties to the agreement. In fact, in that very case, the Texas Supreme Court distinguished a 1920 decision and a 1940 decision from this court and said that is not what is happening here. If there were any doubt, just last year, the Texas Supreme Court in Finley Resources versus Headington reached the same conclusion. I will admit that the court did not expressly cite the stranger to the contract rule, but its outcome leaves no doubt. In that case, Headington and Petro Canyon executed an acreage swap agreement and a release. Finley, an unnamed third party, claimed that the release encompassed it. This generated litigation, and everyone, party and non-party alike, tried to invoke parole evidence rule to describe the, quote, true nature of Finley's relationship and whether it was a predecessor encompassed by the release. Despite Finley's non-party status, the Texas Supreme Court again said no. It said that the parole evidence rule applies and you cannot introduce extrinsic evidence of subjective intent to vary an unambiguous agreement. Again, these were contexts where the evidence was given exactly like it is by appellants in this case to vary unambiguous terms that are not the subject of fraud, ambiguity, or mistake. Now, consistent with these authorities, as I've mentioned, we are not a contractual stranger for all the reasons specifically described. I would like to point to the court to one more decision that I think deserves special attention on this issue. It is Foster versus Bullard from the Austin Court of Appeals. It dealt with a right of first refusal, so it is actually in this very context. And appellants don't, by the way, cite a single case in this context for this theory that we are a stranger to the right of first refusal that their deed is subject to. In Foster, what happened there, just like here, the right of first refusal was breached, so we don't get an offer. We're having to decide, the court, later, what are the terms? The right of first refusal holder wanted to say, actually, I read some press releases, and your purchase price for the acres subject to my right of first refusal is lower. Part of it was lower, the part that's subject to my right of first refusal. The parties who did the deal, in very well-executed and secured documents, said, well, no, our documents establish a specific per-acre price. And the Austin Court of Appeals agreed. It said specifically, we conclude that the closing instruments of August 28th evidence the final integrated agreement and clearly show what character of trade Mutual and Bullard made. The written instruments by which Mutual brought and by which Bullard sold must be presumed to embrace the entire contract, and the prior inconsistent matters contained in the Hendricks contract, even if received in evidence by consent, which of course they weren't here, cannot overcome that presumption. What these cases all teach us, and there are less in this context where it's breached and you're having to determine what was the sale and the offer post hoc, but what they teach us is you look to the unambiguous terms of the third party offer or the third party, when you don't get that, the third party sale that constitutes the breach. There is no reason to alter that rule and create a look-through exception for parties that breach the contract in the first place. With that, I would like to move on to their second argument to try and get out of their unambiguous agreements, which is this theory that party labels do not control. That is true in some settings, and I'll describe them, but it undisputably is not true here. The sole question in this case is not what appellant status was before or after the breach, it's what was it at the time of the breach. And their own unambiguous conveyance documents say, again, that they had no legal control over the other, they were not affiliates. Texas law does grant parties broad power to define the nature of their relationship, and it will be enforced when they do so in an unambiguous contractual writing. We know that Texas is a freedom of contract state. Now, we cited some cases on pages 28 to 29 of our brief, but I think the Enterprise decision deserves the most attention. That very recent case out of the Texas Supreme Court said, you know what? You, in fact, can say you're not partners. And to prevent you from becoming partners, you can even input a condition precedent that says we're not going to become partners unless A, B, and C occur. And the Texas Supreme Court enforced that rule, citing primacy of freedom of contract. The same result should occur here. Now, they cite a host of authorities of their brief. We went through those in our response and put them into the buckets in which they apply. There's three. The first is Coastal. What Coastal holds is that if you say, for example, in that case, it was a disclaimer of partnership, but then the rest of your agreement shows that you share expenses, you share profits, and you all of the duties that we have recognized in Texas of partners, that your label early in the contract is not going to overcome the fact that, in fact, under the terms of your agreement, you are partners. Many of their authorities fall into that bucket. Of course, in this case, we have a clear and unitary and consistent purpose throughout all of these very well-documented agreements. They say we're not partners, not affiliates. Second, there's the no contract bucket. There's a lot of cases they cite for this theory that party labels don't control. There's no contract in them. Of course, AIL is not arguing that if you haven't contractually fixed the status of your relationship, that there should be some different outcome. Third, there's the waiver by subsequent conduct bucket. Enterprise is this case. Enterprise recognized that it had there been a waiver of that condition precedent by subsequent conduct, if you started to act like partners within the terms of the condition precedent, then you would waive your contract. But here again, that's just not relevant to this case because whatever they did after the fact, it's not like a harmless error analysis in this case. What matters in this case is when they executed the sale, did they breach the right of first refusal? The very conveyance documents at issue said they're not affiliates and have no control. Now, the bona fide offer argument they make really repackages all of this, but it fares no better. They do cite authorities nationwide, but you know what those authorities do? They interpret the word sale. Even the treatise they cite states at the bottom that parties should better define the term sale in the right of first refusal documents so that we don't have to decide through other sources how we should define that term. The parties in this case, they defined it to mean any disposition. This court has defined bona fide to mean an offer capable of ripening into a binding contract. And all of the work that they want this court to expand bona fide to do is in the exceptions in this right of first refusal. That is why, because sale is defined so broadly, that we have the mortgage exception. Mortgage don't trigger right of first refusals. We have the affiliate exception. Transfers between affiliates don't trigger the right of first refusal. And we also have the foreclosure exception. This contract already does the work that they want this court to read into the term bona fide, which would render all of those exclusions meaningless or at least superfluous. There's no reason to do that under the terms that the parties agreed to here. And I'd note further that all of those foreign authorities, just to be very clear about what they were, none of them involved contractual disclaimers of the sort in this case. All of them involved transfers to wholly owned entities or wholly owned subsidiaries. Not this case. The clear intent that we know was for Texas Cooley Sub to be a complete different corporate structure, different management, different entity. And it was recorded in a $2 million secured transaction that gave Liberty all the rights and benefits of any party that does a seller financed loan. Those, of course, wouldn't be necessary if all of the extrinsic evidence they want this court to look through and adopt were true. But that's why courts don't rely on extrinsic evidence when the document is clear. On the stock certificate, Justice Womack, you appropriately noted that it was held by a third party. We only found that out, by the way, when there was a disclosure of a document that had previously been argued as privileged. They want the court to infer that it was delivered. If it was delivered to anybody, it was delivered to a third party who represented, under the record, Texas Cooley, not Liberty. Even under a stock document theory, which, by the way, is not even referenced as a security term anywhere in the loan agreements, which actually specifically define the security and have full integration clauses, even if you could look past that, the fact that they want you to believe this was security despite its complete absence from the fully integrated documents, the whole concept of stock document is it has to be delivered in order for it to give you any control. Otherwise, it's just security held in escrow. And that's what we have here. In fact, there was a purchase agreement that is not appended to their brief, which said that those would be delivered after a closing. Of course, if there was a foreclosure, perhaps, and they needed to be used. No evidence of delivery, and they're not relevant regardless because they're not in the wholly integrated agreements.
I have a question.
Yes.
And I know the appellant did not touch on this in his argument, but it's about the attorney's fees. How is it that a fact finder can consider evidence that's not subject to cross-examination without violating due process? I mean, isn't a fundamental tenet of our legal system that no trial will be based on secret evidence?
Your Honor, yes and no. I think in the trade secret context, you often have cases where things are redacted and the other side doesn't get access to it. Mm-hmm. But I think I have two responses to really what you're getting at on that. And the first one is that, and we didn't say this in our briefing, so I want to be clear about it, there was no findings of fact or conclusions of law requested for this fee award. None. And they had the right to do that, and they didn't. So really what they're arguing now, despite the fact that they don't challenge a very lengthy fee affidavit from the lead trial counsel who rested it on her personal knowledge, is that this court should nonetheless presume that the trial court relied only on these unredacted statements, despite the fact that AIL itself said, we don't think you need them. You've got sufficient evidence all on its own. And under this court's law, and in fact, Land versus Land 561 Southwest 3rd 624 from the Houston Court of Appeals, they had the burden because they didn't ask for findings, fact, and conclusions of law to challenge every independent basis for the fee award, and they didn't. But more to your point on the redaction issue, I do recognize that the Anders decision out of the Dallas Court of Appeals is signaling at least that Texas appellate courts are going to start to be more stringent on that practice, which was candidly fairly common in the past. That's why you can find cases on it. But Anders is distinguishable from ours for two reasons. And the first is because there was no other evidence other than those unredacted fee statements submitted in camera. In that case, the challenger said, I can't even respond because these are so heavily redacted. In this case, we got a 20-page response and a 10-page controverting affidavit specifically on things like overbilling or unnecessary or things like that. Clearly, they were able to respond, so the due process issue is not nearly as acute as Anders sought. And the second is that the trial court in that case specifically said, you know what, they can't respond. I'm going to order you to produce the unredacted statements, and I'm going to consider them. In this case, trial court didn't ask for them, and we submitted two other tiers of proof, the redacted fee statements and the attorney fee affidavit. And when they still objected, we said, you know what, we'll submit them in camera, but we really don't think you need them. Very soon after the fee award is granted, there is no evidence on this record that the trial court actually considered it. So we think that they have failed to show, number one, preserve it because they haven't challenged all independent bases despite the failure to ask for findings of fact and conclusions of law, that there's no error, and they haven't shown harm. And so for those reasons, we ask the court to affirm on the fee award. The very last point I want to touch on, just to be responsive, this idea that fair market value, courts should be, you know, turn into appraisal offices and decide if this exchange between a willing buyer and a willing seller with represented fair market value, Texas law specifically rejects that. Texas Supreme Court in Archer says, no. The third party offer sets the price. The Foster decision I spoke with y'all about earlier says exactly that, and we have cited two cases in our brief that said true value is not the test because, of course, there are going to be all sorts of reasons that parties might effectuate a sale below or above. In either case, you don't get to impeach it later. That is the whole point of a right of first refusal. For all of those reasons, we would ask the court to affirm.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Drabble?
I did not address the attorney fee award in my opening argument, but I did want to make a correction. One thing is that because this was decided on summary judgment, We did not, it's true, Liberty and TX Cooley did not request findings of fact and conclusions of law, and it would have been inappropriate for the trial court to render that. Also, this argument that we failed to preserve that point by not requesting findings of fact and conclusions of law was not made in the appellee's brief, so they have waived that argument. This is the first time I've heard of it today. That's all I have to say about the award of attorney's fees, but turning to the issue of the bona fide offer, AIL has stated that in the cases that were decided out of state, all the other courts were just interpreting what sale means in the right of first refusal. That is not true. If this court looks at the Third Circuit's decision in Crick versus Texaco Antilles, the California Court of Appeals decision in Hartzman versus Valley Land and Cattle Company, and the Sixth Circuit's decision in Evans versus SC Southfield 12 Associates, all of those cases are interpreting the term bona fide offer as used in the right of first refusal, and that's the exact same language that is used in Exhibit E to the deed. And all of those cases held consistently that a bona fide offer does require an arm's length transaction with an actual change in control of the property. As for the stranger to the contract exception, Appellees did file a letter brief yesterday. We'll follow up on that and explain why they're incorrect on the law. But I would just like to point this court out to its own precedent in Pennington versus Vevering, and it stated there that the rule as to the exclusion of oral testimony to contradict or vary the terms of a written contract is applicable only as between the parties to such a contract. A stranger to such written instrument is not bound by its terms, and therefore he cannot hold other parties bound by the same. That's Pennington versus Beverly. That was cited in our reply brief. Subsequently, this court decided Eckel versus First National Bank of Fort Worth with the same principle. Eckel was a writ refused case, which, as the court knows, carries the same precedential weight as one of the Texas Supreme Court's own opinions. The Texas Supreme Court has never overruled Eckel, and it certainly didn't do so in Finley, where opposing counsel admits that it was not an issue in that case. No party raised the stranger to the contract exception, and as you know, the Texas Supreme Court does not overrule its precedent sub silentio. So this court should follow its own prior precedent and those of the Texas Supreme Court without regard to what the first and third courts have held on this issue. And again, I take the court back to Coastal Plains. I think that is very instructive here. In that case, it was the parties to the contract, and the court nevertheless said that they could introduce extrinsic evidence to show that the description in the contract did not match the substance of their relationship. And Liberty and TX Cooley have done that below and shown that despite the statements in the contract that they are not affiliates, they do qualify under the definition of affiliates in Exhibit E to the deed.
What if somebody sues you for having control of this property? Are you now going to say, turn back and say, you're not affiliates?
Well, I mean, and it would depend on the facts of that case. I mean, control of the property and ownership of the property are two different things. I mean, to the extent that liability flows from ownership, Liberty doesn't own the property. It's held by TX Cooley. There's nothing wrong about that. I mean, that's what parties set up subsidiary companies all the time to do. And the evidence shows that was the purpose of the transaction, is just to put it in a single purpose entity for the purpose of limiting
parole liability. Evidence shows that's the purpose of the transaction.
I'm sorry?
The parole evidence shows that's the purpose of the transaction.
That is true. It is extrinsic to the it is extrinsic to the contract, but it was also undisputed that that's what the evidence was. And finally, I would just like to go back to Energy Transfer. That did not overrule Coastal, despite the suggestions to the contrary. In Energy Transfer, the Supreme Court asked whether parties could contractually agree to override the statutory factors for creation of a partnership and impose a condition precedent. The court said they could. They discussed Coastal Plains in that case and said this was not the same situation, so Coastal Plains wasn't implicated. And importantly, they said that the parties' agreement that they would not be partners, of course, is not binding on third parties. It's only binding as to them. And AIL is a third party to these loan documents, so Liberty and TX Cooley's description of their relationship is not binding on AIL. So for those reasons, we ask this court to reverse, consistent with our prayer. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, counselors. Your argument has been helpful to the court. We appreciate your being here today. Your case has now been submitted, and you're free to go about your business.